You know, it's been nearly, or very, very close to 30 years since Mr. Armstrong died. I think we're all in the church now. We're starting to get a bit weary, getting a bit tired, and it's a dangerous position to be in. If we turn over to Matthew chapter 24, Matthew 24, because it does tell us in verse 42, it says, "Watch therefore, for you don't know what hour your Lord has come." And this is the problem, we don't know. And neither did the early apostles. They thought he would be coming very soon, and it was another 2,000 years. And of course, if he'd been told it was going to be 2,000 years away, they'd have been discouraged by it. And if we were told the death of Mr. Armstrong would be another 30 years at least, we would be discouraged by it. And quite frankly, even now, we look at the situation, and we do wonder, you know, watch for you, therefore, for you don't know what hour your Lord has come. And watching helps us to see the events that take place. Mr. Henderson brings out repeatedly the fact is that we're watching for events rather than dates, and dates aren't given to us. He says, "But know this, that if the good man of the house had known in what watch the thief would have come, he would have watched and would not allow his house to be broken up." And we had some fuel actually taken from some outhouses some months and years ago. And if I'd known that they were going to come on a particular night, I'd been watching, I'd been waiting for them. But I didn't. In fact, I didn't even discover it had gone until weeks and weeks and weeks later. I happened to notice that some fuel had been taken. And this is what he's saying. He's saying, "But know this, that if the good man of the house had known what watch night the thief would have come, he would have watched and would not have allowed his house to be broken up." And our household was broken up. We were not on the ball. We were not watching. We were not really aware of the times that we're in at that time. "Therefore, you be ready." Now, that's a command. You be ready. "For in such an hour as you do not think, the Son of Man comes." Now, we can say it's going to go on for an awful lot of time, and then he comes early. Or we can say he's going to come early, and he goes on for an awful lot of time. Well, if we say he's going to come early, and he goes on for an awful lot of time, that is not going to catch us on the hop, because we're going to say, "Oh, he's going to come any minute now." It's got to be the other way around. It's got to be the fact that we are saying is, or somebody is saying, that it's going to be some years down the line, and he comes sooner. That's the only way around you can actually read that verse. It's got to be the fact that people are saying that it is, as it goes on, it talks about the Lord delays his coming. "Therefore, you be ready." So the key is that we've got to be ready all the time. We've got to be watching. We've got to be alert. We've got to be on the ball. We've got to be doing what is necessary. "For in such an hour as you think not, the Son of Man comes." So it's going to come as a surprise. Whenever it is, it's going to surprise us. And remember, it's such an hour as you think not. And he's talking to his disciples at that time, and his disciples down through the ages. "Who then is a faithful and wise servant?" And quite frankly, it's talking to the ministry predominantly there, because he's a minister means servant. "Whom his Lord has made a ruler over his household." So again, a minister gets up here to speak and rules the household of God on Christ's behalf. "To give them food in due season." That's what we need to be doing. As he goes on, he says, "Blessed is that servant who his Lord, when he comes, shall find so doing." So it's imperative that we in the ministry are giving food in due season. And the season is the time that we find ourselves in right now. And that time is just before the end. And it's within all of these warnings about watching, that you don't know what hour it's going to come. The Lord has come. It says that you be ready, for in such an hour as you think not that the Lord comes. And in all these areas of warning, he's saying that we've got to be so doing. In other words, teaching and giving food in due season. "Truly I say to you that he'll make him ruler over all his goods, but... And if that evil servant shall say in his heart..." Now, he doesn't have to actually go out and say it himself. It's saying in his heart, notice, "My Lord delays his coming." Now, how does he do that? Well, what he says reflects the fact that he doesn't believe that Christ is coming is immediately. It's reflecting the fact that it's delayed. And so what he's doing, what he's actually saying, the way he's preaching, the way that the things that are coming out of his mouth reflect that heart. That's how you say in his heart. Why? It's got to be in his heart. It's got to be there, even if it doesn't come out of his mouth. He may not say it directly, but what he is saying is coming from a heart that is, in fact, believing that. And shall begin to smite his fellow servants, that's even with the tongue, and to eat and drink with the drunken. And we're looking at the Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth. And we're looking at the wine of a fornication that made all the nations drunk with that wine of a fornication. And therefore the doctrines coming into the church are Christian, in quotes, are worldly, are going in a worldly direction. And to eat and drink with the drunken, then the Lord of that servant shall come in a day when he is not looking for him, when his hour is not aware of. In other words, if you're saying in our hearts, my Lord delays his coming, and that's then influencing our plans and the way we're looking at things, the way we're doing things, and what we're getting up here to say, then it's going to be the fact that he's going to come in an hour that he's not aware of. And he will cut him off and appoint his portion with the hypocrites, and there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So it's at a time, it says, for you don't know what hour your Lord comes, verse 42, and it is a time and an hour that you think not, in verse 44. And the warning is that we do not say in our heart, my Lord delays his coming, because if we do that, and it's reflected in our actions, reflected in what we're saying, then there's going to be problems. And unfortunately, we are finding that we're getting weary. We're all getting weary. We're looking at the future. We think, well, you know, how much longer are we going to wait? And you can quite easily think, well, it's going to go on for some time yet. I mean, turn over to 2 Peter 3, first of all. 2 Peter 3. Because it's not just over in Matthew 24, though that is a key verse. Peter also deals with the problem and mentions and makes a prophetic statement in 2 Peter chapter 3, where it says, this second epistle, beloved, I now write to you in both which I stir up your pure minds by way of remembrance, that you may be mindful of the words which were spoken before by the holy prophets and of the commandments of us, the apostles of our Lord and Saviour. So apostleship is a crucial area in keeping our mind focused in the right direction. Knowing this first, in other words, keeping this in mind, that there will come, in the last days, scoffers walking after their own lusts, after what they want. And they are saying, where's the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. Now, saying in his heart, our Lord delays his coming, it reflects itself in, you know, well, things are just... I remember listening to a minister at one time who said, if the... time goes on for 1,000 years, people will know that there was a Church of God here. And that was his approach. That was the way he looked at things. I remember another minister that I came across who was insistent that the temple had to be rebuilt, the physical temple had to be rebuilt. Now you see, what counters these things is the fact that Mr. Armstrong said, no, it doesn't. It doesn't have to be rebuilt. In fact, he said, looking at the situation in the Middle East, it's almost impossible for it to be rebuilt. And he could see the daily sacrifices could be put up and in place with an altar. And the altar is already built. The altar is already prefabricated and waiting to go. They found a red heifer. They've got the priestly garments. All the bits and pieces are there. And the indication was that when the temples were built before, under Ezra and Nehemiah, it was actually a case of they're offering the daily sacrifices, the evening and morning sacrifice, well before the temple is actually built. Now, the plans for the temple, yes, and there may well be plans for the temple, but it does not have to be rebuilt. And yet, if it does, if you look at it that way, then you're saying the Lord delays his coming. I remember reading something where somebody is reckoning that there had to be 3.5 years of sacrifices before the beast power rises. And that is a current view of one particular group. Another area that we need to be aware of is that, yes, looking at what Mr. Armstrong said, it looks on paper that it'll be an outright attack by the EU on the United States and UK. But there are other things that he said as well, as we'll go on and look at, that have other things to say. But here it says, knowing this first, that there shall come in the last days scoffers walking after their own lusts, and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. For this they're willingly ignorant, that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing in out of the water and in the water, whereby the world that then was, being overflowed with water, perished. But the heavens and the earth, which are now, by the same word, are kept in store reserved to fire against the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. There's a sequence of events, there's a plan of God, and the way that things are going, your God is fully aware of the position that we find ourselves in today. He hasn't gone off somewhere. He knows his church. We can get on our knees still and we can talk to him directly, as it was brought out in the world tomorrow today. Christ is very much on the job. The Father has not said that now is the time, but the Father knows the time. He knows when he's going to draw the line and say, right, now. And Christ is confident of that, and we should have the confidence of that as well. But the heavens and the earth, which are now by the same word, are kept in store, reserved to fire against the day of judgment and the perdition of ungodly men. But, beloved, don't be ignorant of this one thing, that one day with the Lord is 1,000 years and 1,000 years one day. And a few times I've given a sermon where you literally take the 1,000 years being as a day, being as the preparation day for the Sabbath that's coming, and the Sabbath being the 1,000 years millennium. And it's interesting, putting all the various events, you know, the invention of printing presses, and the invention of the actual printing of the scriptures, and making the scriptures, you know, Tyndale and so on, and making the scriptures available, the invention of the radio, invention of the television, the invention of long-distance cables. These all, the vast majority of them, they all happened on a Friday. They all happened on a Friday in the last 1,000 years. But more than that, they all virtually happened when you really look at the things that are needed. They all happened in the last hour or so, last few hours, just leading up to the Sabbath. And that is the case. Don't be ignorant. One day with God is a 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. The Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some man count slackness. Because he's saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. And he's countering that. He's saying the Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some man counts slackness, but is long-suffering towards us. He's allowed the shattering to take place. We are under we are being tested right now. We are being tested to see how we are performing on an individual basis. The temple to which Christ is to return is being assessed. That again is what you find over in... in fact, let's have a look in that particular scripture. I wasn't going to read it, but over in Revelation. You see, I remember reading a discourse from another group in about chapter 11, where it says, there was given me a reed like unto a rod, and the angel stood, saying, rise and measure this temple of God and the altar and those that worship therein. But the court which is outside the temple leave out and don't measure it, for it's given to the Gentiles, and the holy city shall they tread underfoot 42 months. And he was categoric that a temple had to be built. A physical temple. This is talking about a physical temple. Why would he say that? Because if you look at the context of it, it's very clear that it talks about the little book in verse 8 of the chapter 10. The voice I heard in heaven said to me, go and take the little book which is open in the hand of the angel that stands upon the sea. And I went and give me the little book, and he said, take and eat it up, and make your belly bitter, and in your mouth as sweet as honey. And that ties back to Ezekiel and taking the message to the Israelites. And this is what Mr. Armstrong did. And I took the little book in the angel's hand and ate it up, and it was in my mouth as sweet as honey. But as soon as I had eaten it, my belly was bitter. And Mr. Armstrong explained what that is about. You're looking at the fact that the message was sweet as honey because it's the coming kingdom of God. But it was bitter because it was some way yet. It hadn't actually come yet. And then he said to me, you must prophesy again before many peoples, nations, tongues and kings. And that was done. That began in the 70s, went into the 80s, and he did that. And then the next part is a reed like a rod and rise measure of the temple. And so the only thing that you can really draw the conclusion is that that temple is the spiritual temple, which again Mr. Armstrong specified. You're not looking at a physical temple that's got to be rebuilt. Now, if that is the case, we're at that juncture, we're being assessed. But this particular minister was writing, and he was saying that it was a physical temple. Why? Because he rejects the understanding of the preceding verses. That's why. He doesn't accept the fact that Mr. Armstrong did that. And in not accepting that, you're therefore looking at things in a different way, looking at the prophecies in a different way. You're not assessing them in the way Mr. Armstrong assessed them and where Jesus Christ led Mr. Armstrong to assess them. If we turn back to Luke chapter 12, in Luke chapter 12, we find in verse 29, it says, and seek not what you shall eat, or what you shall drink, neither be of doubtful mind, because this is what we can go, you know, we can almost throw up our hands and say, okay, enough's enough, we'll go ahead and we'll eat and drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Because we're all getting longer in the tooth, we're all approaching death in that sense. And I tell you, I was just saying to somebody earlier on, yesterday, I went and lay down for 5 minutes, and 2 hours later I woke up. And that's the way it goes sometimes. You know, we're all getting older. We don't have the energy that we used to. We just simply don't. It says, and seek not what you shall eat or what you shall drink, neither be of doubtful mind. In other words, don't worry about these things. For all these things the nations of the world seek after, and your heavenly Father knows that you have need of all these things. So God knows what we need on a physical basis and a physical level. But rather seek the kingdom of God, and all these things will be added to you. Fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Sell that you have and give alms. Provide yourself bags. In other words, simplify your life. Get your life simplified. You need to get some rubbish sold, get the stuff sold, and simplify the life that's necessary. Sell that you have and give alms. Provide yourself bags which wax not old, a treasure in the heavens that fails not, where no thief approaches, neither moth corrupts. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Let your loins be girt about and your lights burning. In other words, get your concentration on making sure the lights are. Remember the wise and the foolish virgins? This certainly ties in with that. Our lights need to be burning. We need to be ready for off, in that sense. And you yourself, like to men that wait for their Lord when he'll return from the wedding, that when he comes and knocks, and what does it say about Laodicea? It says about, you know, he stands at the door and knocks. When he comes and knocks, they may be open to him immediately. There's no hesitation. They know what it's about. They know where he's going. It's not a case of my Lord delays his coming. The case is we're waiting. We're ready and waiting. Blessed are those servants whom when the Lord, when he comes, shall find watching. Truly I say to you that he shall gird himself and make them sit down for food, and will come forth and will serve them. And if he comes in the second watch, or comes in the third watch, and finds them so, blessed are those servants. Now, the watches were 6 to 9, that was the first watch. The second one was 9 o'clock till 12 o'clock at night. And the third watch was 12 o'clock to 3 o'clock in the morning. So if he comes in the second, if he comes in the third, It could be 3 o'clock in the morning. We certainly didn't expect him to come at 3 o'clock in the morning. But if he does happen to be that way, then it says, and if he comes in the second watch or comes in the third watch and finds them so, blessed are those servants. And this know, that if the good man of the house had known what hour the thief would have come, he would have watched and would not allow his house to be broken through. And then they say, our household was broken up. The church is shattered. Be therefore ready also, for the Son of Man comes at an hour when you do not think. And that instruction, that we need to be ready, we need to be found watching, we need to be waiting for that event to occur, is something that we need to take to heart, the instruction, and remain vigilant over the decades, if necessary, to avoid this saying in our heart, our Lord delays his coming. And this is really what I would like to talk about a little bit today, that we do, if you like, avoid this concept of our Lord delays his coming, and we start to realize that, first of all, that he comes suddenly, and that is certainly something that we need to keep in mind. I mean, the Europe that we're looking for at the moment, the Europe that is going to form, is not the Europe that we see today. I don't know whether you saw the picture that we've got on the website for Europe, the news analysis segment of the website. But it's a picture of Juncker. Is it Juncker? Is that how it's pronounced? I think it is. And in the background, you see the shadow of Hitler. Because, you know, Mr. Juncker is doing things which seems crazy. It is his position, and is actually putting him in that position. And yet it's all part of the plan, and there is somebody in the background waiting to take control, who is regarded as by Christ, by God the Father, as the beast. Now, who he is, we don't know. We don't know. But that's certainly what we're looking at. As I say, not at the present, but the legislation is being laid down. The infrastructure is being laid down. The cameras that we see today. I mean, in the UK, the number of cameras that we've got are colossal. Absolutely colossal. These things are being laid down, and they're being laid down for a purpose, and they will be used. The infrastructure of snooping on the internet is being laid down. It's being laid down to counter terrorism, yes, but we know that it's also going to be used against the church. It's going to be used against the people of God in the future. So these things will come, and when it comes, it'll come very suddenly. Now, let's turn over to Isaiah chapter 30. Isaiah 30. Isaiah 30, let's pick it up in verse 8. It says, now go and write it before them in a table, and note it in a book, that it may be in for the time to come forever and ever, that this is a rebellious people, lying children, children that will not hear the law of the Eternal. And this is a real problem. Which say to the seers, do not see, and to the prophets, do not prophesy unto us right things, speak unto us smooth things, prophesy deceits. And that is something that we find today in society generally. They will not listen to what God has to say. In fact, there's this adamant atheistic back current to all teaching, and they try and tear down anything that gives a hint that they're being a God. Get you out of the way, turn aside out of the path, cause the Holy One of Israel to cease from before us. That again is something that we see clearly. Wherefore thus says the Holy One of Israel, because you despise this word and trust in oppression and perverseness, and stay thereon, therefore this iniquity shall be to you as a breach ready to fall, swelling out of the high wall, whose breaking comes suddenly at an instant. And that is the way it's going to come. That is the way it will actually occur. And I know that we've had, I think Donald Rumsfeld has said, I didn't get his actual quote before coming up here, but he said along the lines that we need to expect an outrage greater than 9/11. And that is what is expected. Now, whether that is a false flag event or whether that is real. You know, and you can't tell, let's face it. We're all conspiracy theorists, notwithstanding, you cannot tell whether it's a false flag or not because they'll cover their tracks. But it's only a matter of time. I think the MI5 head some years ago talked about it's only a matter of time before nuclear weapons are in hand of terrorists. And certainly that is the case. Terrorism is a very, very different enemy. And they have the chance of having nuclear weapons. And if they do, well, let's turn over to Isaiah 9. Let's go back to Isaiah 9. Because again, if we say in our hearts, our Lord delays his coming, we're looking for the temple to be rebuilt, we're looking for 3.5 years of sacrifices to be offered, or perhaps 3.5 years of famine before the tribulation comes, which is again another doctrine which I, or understanding that I heard somebody give, then we're going to be pushing that date further and further back. And it's pushing that date further and further back that is the real danger, the real danger. But here in Isaiah 9, it says in verse 6, it says, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. And the government shall be on his shoulders, and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace." So Christ, when he comes, he marries his church. Christ's bride, the church, will be the mother. And then the rest of humanity comes as a result of that union. "The Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there shall be no end. Upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom to order it and to establish it with judgment and justice from henceforth even forever. And the zeal of the Eternal of Hosts will perform this." And he goes on, he says, "The Lord sent a word to Jacob and it's lighted upon Israel. And all the people shall know, even Ephraim and the inhabitants of Samaria." Now, Samaria was where Israel, the house of Israel, was. It was centered on the area of Samaria. And that was the capital of the northern tribes. "And they say in the pride and the stoutness of heart, the bricks are fallen down, but we'll build them with hewn stones. The sycamores are cut down, but we'll change them into cedars." And there's been quite a bit on the internet about people that have actually said things like this regarding 9/11. And they've even got cedars in place of a sycamore tree. And they've gone ahead and built things with hewn stones that were formerly built with brick to show their rebellion, quite frankly, against the terrorists, they think. But no, what this verse is talking about is their rebellion against God. And it says, "Therefore the Eternal shall set up the adversaries of Rezin," that's the king of Syria, "against him, and join his enemies together." Now, that didn't happen the first time around. As we'll go on and we'll actually examine the first time and how actually what happened the first time around. But this, the joining his enemies together, you know, Assyria didn't join with Syria and didn't join with all the other people in that area to take down Israel. Assyria took down Israel by itself, having first destroyed Syria. Assyria came in from Nineveh and then destroyed Syria. And as I say, we'll have a look at that in a minute. But it says, "The Syrians before and the Philistines behind, and they shall devour Israel with an open mouth. And for all this, his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still." He's going to carry on and do even more than that. "But the Syrians and the Palestinians are, if you like, in league," according to Psalm 83, "in league with the children of Lot, and also with the children of Lot are in league with Assyria." But in verse 13, "For the people turns not unto him that smite them, neither do they seek the Eternal of Hosts. Therefore the Eternal will cut off from Israel head and tail, branch and rush, in one day." Now that did not happen. It didn't happen. "The ancient, the honorable, he is the head, and the prophet he teaches lies, he is the tail. For the leader of this people causes them to err, and they are led of them are destroyed. And therefore the Lord shall have no joy in the young men." No, we'll leave it at that. But the leaders are going to be destroyed. And certainly one thing that can certainly do that is the subject of nuclear terrorism. That can, in fact, if you can just think of a situation that could take place, and just a possibility that could happen, if nuclear terrorism is used, where is it coming from? Who, in fact, has supplied the nuclear weapons? He talks about all your cities being destroyed. Well, you know, where has that come from? Where has it been supplied from? People would not necessarily know. They wouldn't know. And if something like that did happen within this world, the world is going to change overnight. You talk about fascist, you talk about right-wing extremists, it is going to be absolutely immediate. There will be martial law across the earth. It will not just be in one country. Wherever the attack takes place, it won't be just in that one country. They say it could be false flag, it could be genuine. But the thing is that we've seen it already happen as far as the church is concerned. We've seen it take place where it's come from inside, from the top. Now, that should at least teach us something. It's not that the final configuration is going to be inside from the top. It's not that. But and we'll go on and see that in a little while. But as far as the coming suddenly, every indication is that it will indeed come suddenly. In one day, as it says in verse 13, in verse 14, sorry, therefore the Eternal will cut off from Israel head and tail, branch and rush in one day. It's going to be sudden, it's going to be instantaneous. Turn over to 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. And again, here we find another passage which is disputed by some. Whereas the apostasy they don't recognize is as the apostasy, and because they don't recognize the church as being something truly special, truly the one true church, they can extend the boundaries to the areas of, you know, believing that, not believing in God, but that's here in 1 Thessalonians 4. But 1 Thessalonians 4, let's take verse 16. It says, for the Lord himself shall descend from heaven with a shout and with the voice of the archangel and with the trump of God, and the dead in Christ shall rise first. Then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and we will be ever with the Lord. Therefore comfort one another with these words. So we see very clearly the trump of God, and we're looking at the right at the very end time, for it shows the positioning very clearly of what that time, where that time is that he's discussing. And he says, but of the times and the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I write to you. For you yourself know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night. For when they shall say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them, as travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. So it is going to be sudden. And as I said, when you're looking at 2 Thessalonians, and what in fact the interpretation as far as 2 Thessalonians 2 is concerned, you can, various people are not going to be able to recognize what is actually going on, what has actually taken place. They're going to be pushing the date back. And if you put the date back, you're in dead trouble, because it says, when they say peace and safety, and so the world at large is going to be saying peace and safety, so there could well be a terrorist outrage of some description. The world would change overnight, but then they would say peace and safety, but then sudden destruction comes. For when they shall say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them as travail upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. But you, brethren, are not in darkness, that the day should overtake you as a thief. So whatever has been given to the Church of God allows us to see sufficiently not to be in darkness. You're all the children of the light and the children of the day. We're not of the night nor of darkness. Therefore, don't let us sleep as do others, but let us watch and be sober. Let us watch and be sober and not sleep. And watching world news, watching the things that are going on, watching our own spiritual condition, yes, certainly. There's no question of that. In fact, a vital area is that we watch our spiritual condition, because that is the only thing that will save us. That is the only thing that will actually give us protection. But we are expected to be watching world conditions as well. That is part of this, the mix, if you like. And that's clearly shown in, when you look in Matthew 24. Let's just remind ourselves where in fact this is going to be coming from. Revelation 17. This is the ultimate source of what will in fact take place. And we recognize this and we understand this. But as I say, nuclear terrorism is something that... before we read Revelation 17, let me just go and read what Mr. Armstrong had to say in 1982. In April the 21st, a co-worker letter in 1982, he says, "The secret of atomic and hydrogen military technology is no longer even remotely secret. Possibly half a dozen additional countries already secretly possess nuclear weapons." Now this was 1982, this was the case. "The shocking fact is that no less than 35 countries already have or will have by 1985 the technological know-how and the capacity to produce nuclear weapons. These include Argentina, Brazil, Israel, Iraq, South Korea, Egypt, Libya, Pakistan, South Africa, Taiwan and Yugoslavia." Now many of those have had broken up and had problems. Many of them have problems right now, such as Pakistan, which has got a nuclear arsenal. And if that falls into the wrong hands, and do you think we're going to be told? There's no way we'd be told. And has it already happened? How many of these things have fallen into the wrong hands already? How many are out? You know, the focus is on Iran, not actually gaining a nuclear weapon, because of what he's been saying. But how many of these things are already out? What happened to the nuclear stockpile that the Soviet Union had? Again, would they tell you? Would they tell us? The answer is no, of course not. It says, "No corner of the globe will be safe from the spectre of cataclysmic destruction." Now, if that is the case, the cities to be destroyed, which we know they will, does it have to be an all-right-out attack by Germany? It doesn't. Now, we'll read here in Revelation 18, or 17 rather, we'll see that in fact it's the beast power is going to be a European-based power. It'll be a continuation of the what went before, all the way back to Babylon. But it says, "No corner of the globe will be safe from the spectre of cataclysmic destruction. Even more disturbing is the growing prospect of nuclear terrorism, nuclear mass murder by madmen bent on their own insane goals." What if ISIS got hold of the bomb? What if they did? They're threatening any... Not only do they threaten to go ahead and cause mayhem within the EU and within Britain, but they're prepared to go ahead and blow themselves up. And so how little regard is there for human life? I look at Islam and I just wonder, and I look at it and I think it is a religion designed for the end time. It has specifically been tailor-made for the end time. And what we're looking at, we're witnessing it rising to its fore. Even more disturbing is the growing prospect of nuclear terrorism, nuclear mass murder by madmen bent on their own insane goals. Many authorities believe that when the next nuclear bomb is used, it'll be by terrorists and not by a national government. And that was in 1982. And how much more is that the case now? And yet could we go to sleep? Could we go ahead and think, well, the temple's got to be rebuilt, there's another 3.5 years of sacrifices, and start having these various doctrines? And what's the doctrine coming from? From a mindset, thinking in our heart that the Lord delays his coming. It may not, that's not what they're saying, it's not what's being said, but that's where it's coming from. It's from a mindset. We've got to guard against that mindset. And quite frankly, by going back to some of these co-worker letters and understanding a little bit more about what Mr. Armstrong did really say, we need to make sure that we are not going of that mindset. We aren't getting sleepy. We are still on the job. We're still on the ball. Even more disturbing is the growing prospect of nuclear terrorism, the nuclear mass murder by madmen bent on their own insane goals. Many authorities believe that when the next nuclear bombing is used, it will be used by terrorists and not by a national government. The destructive capacity of nuclear bombs in terrorist hands is a growing risk. It's a growing risk, notice. It is documented fact that uranium and plutonium, vital nuclear arms materials, have been stolen, smuggled internationally, and offered for sale. Where do they go? Are they still there? What, in fact, is, you know, what was the nuclear arsenal? What was the arsenal in Syria? Where did all the arsenal go? And again, weapons of mass destruction? Have they fallen into the hands of ISIS? You know, David Cameron, Mr. Cameron, has said that that is the greatest threat, is people coming back from the war in Syria, bringing their ideas back into this country, and bringing their terrorism back into this country. And there it is. In 82, Mr. Armstrong said that there's a growing risk. It's a documented fact that uranium and plutonium, vital nuclear arms materials, have been stolen, smuggled internationally, and offered for sale. One expert estimates that there's enough material unaccounted for at American facilities alone to make more than 20 plutonium bombs and half a dozen uranium bombs. That's just from the U.S., again in 82. And you look in the Soviet Union, and the record keeping is probably a great deal less than you find over in the West. Chernobyl is an example. Officials have no idea where this nuclear material is. In addition, a terrorist group's experts fear that unstable regimes in various countries could also get the bomb. An unbalanced third world dictator with a nuclear device could kill millions of people. ISIS is declaring a new nation, an Islamic nation, northern part of Iraq, southern part of Syria, and anybody else they managed to get his hands on. Interested in Mosul, is right on the border at that time. Now, Mosul is the new name for Nineveh. Nineveh is on one side of the bank. All the ruins of Nineveh of old is on one side of the bank. Mosul is on the other, with the Tigris. So that's where, it's interesting that it's focusing back on that area again. Not that I make anything of it, but it's just an interesting fact. If you see the word Mosul being used, just be aware that that is ancient Nineveh. It just happens to be on the other side of the Tigris. In addition to terrorist groups, experts fear that unstable regimes in various countries could also get the bomb. An unbalanced third world dictator with a nuclear device could kill millions of people. A new Stalin or Hitler in a major nation would have the stockpiles to literally obliterate the entire human race. The nuclear genie is out of the bottle. Events are even now impelling the world towards a time of cataclysmic destruction. It is time to awake to the imminence of nuclear war and also to the imminence of nuclear terrorism. That was in 82. And how much more is the case today? And here in Revelation 17, so what in fact is going to take place as far as is mentioned here in Revelation 17? It says in verse 9, it says, "And here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains," or seven governments in other words, which on which the woman sits. "And there are seven kings, five are fallen." So you've got the five falling with Napoleon when he actually saw this. And again, this was revealed to Mr. Armstrong by Jesus Christ at a specific time when this was the case. And he could look at this particular... there was only a very narrow margin as to when this would actually occur. And yet it was at that precise time that this was revealed. Five are fallen, one is, and the other is not yet come. One is with the Mussolini and Hitler, and the other is not yet come. Yet when he comes, he must continue a short space. So he could see that. He certainly thought he was going to come much, much sooner than it has. But he could see that this was the positioning of these verses. And the beast that was and is not, even he is of the eighth, he's the eighth Babylonian system. And he's of the seven, he's of the seven that preceded him. That's the one that was there. And he goes into perdition. And the seven and the ten horns which you saw are ten kings that have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive power as kings 1 hour, a very short time indeed, with the beast. So when that beast power arises, there will be ten kings there, in addition to the beast. And these have one mind, and shall give their power and their strength to the beast. Now, if they have got to give their strength and power to the beast, it looks like there's going to be some kind of pseudo-democratic system involved. If it's a pseudo-democratic system, which is exactly what we've got in Europe, exactly what we've got in Europe right now. So, as I said, the infrastructure is being laid down. The political structure is being laid down in Europe. But the actual final resurrected head is very, very different. Very, very different from what we see now. But all the pieces are falling into place now. These have one mind and shall give their power and their strength to the beast. They shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for his Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. So it lasts right to the end time, and these ten kings are going to fight Christ. So it is very clear as to when this actually occurs. It's just before the return of Christ. And you put the other scriptures together, and it becomes very clear that this is the Assyria, the Assyrian rather, is the one that will actually go ahead and overcome Israel. And certainly, if you turn over, let's turn over to Isaiah chapter 10, where we were back in Isaiah 9 previously, but if we go back to Isaiah 10, we see here in Isaiah 10 verse 5, it says, Assyrian, the rod of my anger and the staff of my in their hand is my indignation. So now this happened in days gone by. It happened to Israel the first time round. We're going to have a look at what actually took place at that time. But it's going to happen again. It's the duality of prophecy, and this is what Mr. Armstrong recognized, this duality that is there. I'll send him against a hypocritical nation and against the people of my wrath. Will I give him a charge to take the spoil and to take the prey and to tread them down like mire in the streets? Howbeit he does not mean so, neither does his heart think so, but it's in his heart to destroy and to cut off nations, not a few. Now, whether that's going to be talking about the fact that he was relatively peaceful until something happened, which I personally think is the case, or whether it's the case that he reckoned he was doing it all on his own strength and he didn't realize that it was God actually that was using him to do his work and to do his operation. It's unclear as to which way around that is. But either way around, he is not aware of what's actually going on. He's not aware of his position. And his position is there to correct Israel. And it says in verse 12, it says, therefore it shall come to pass that when the Lord has performed his whole work upon Mount Zion and upon Jerusalem. So his focus is on the church and on the ones around the church, which is Jerusalem. Zion is the holy place, or the place where the temple was. But the church, it extends beyond those boundaries to those that are actually around the holy place. And I'll punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his high looks. For he says, by the strength of my hand I've done it, and by my wisdom, for I am prudent, I have removed the bounds of the people and have robbed their treasures, and I have put down the inhabitants like a valiant man. And my hand has found a nest of the riches of the people, as one gathered eggs that are left. I've gathered all the earth, and there was none that moved a wing or opened a mouth or peeped. And shall the axe boast itself against him that hews therewith? Or shall the saw magnify itself against him that shakes it? And if the rod should shake itself against them that lift it up, or if the staff should lift itself up as if it was no wood? In other words, God was using him, and he's using him for a purpose, and he doesn't acknowledge that purpose. And the fact that he is talking about the end time, if you just go on over to verse 33. It says, "Behold, the Lord, the Eternal of hosts, shall lop the bough with terror, and the high ones of stature shall be hewn down, the haughty shall be humbled, and he shall cut down the thickets of the forest with iron, and Lebanon shall fall by a mighty hand, mighty one, that is Jesus Christ. And there shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots, and the Spirit of the Eternal shall rest upon him." And he goes into the, how the wolf shall dwell with a lamb, verse 6, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion. So you're going, it's clearly an end-time application, clearly end-time application. And therefore, clearly, this is dual. This is not just what happened years and years ago. If we turn over to Hosea, let's take it up in verse 5. Because, as I say, nuclear terrorism was highlighted by Mr. Armstrong as a possibility. Today, it's even more of a probability. I think the indication of what happened to the church, that it was attacked from inside and from the top, or with the acquiescence of the people from inside and from the top. It was actually attacked from outside. It was the ideas that came into the church came from, did not come from the top and inside the church. They came from outside the church, but they came via that conduit. Is it also telling us that in such a way, you know, be ready, because in such a way the Son of Man comes? Is it also telling us to be ready in such a way that the problems that are going to come in this world are going to come via that conduit? It may be, but certainly we know it's going to be sudden. We know that we are not going to be expecting it. Therefore, the idea that the Lord delayed his coming, that attitude of mind is a fatal one to have in the present scenario. And here in Hosea chapter 5, verse 12, it says, "Therefore shall I be like to Ephraim as a moth, and the house of Judah as rottenness." So Ephraim, the nation of Israel, and Ephraim and Manasseh, "when Ephraim saw his sickness, and Judah saw his wound, then went Ephraim to the Assyrian and sent to King Jareb." Now Ephraim never went to the Assyrian. He didn't, not in days gone by he didn't. This is another time. Now Judah went to the Assyrian. Yeah, Judah did, but Ephraim didn't. Ephraim was in Samaria, and they had to, it was under siege for 3 years. "And said to King Jareb, yet he could not heal you or cure you of your wound. And would you go," and let's face it, if it was an outright attack from the resurrected beast power, headed by a resurrected Germany, a militarily active Germany, would you go to Assyria? Would you go to King Jareb, which is the one, you know, the king of strife, the beast, if you knew that that was where the attack came from? The indication is it's going to be subtle. There's more to it. The same has happened in the church. The church, it was not an outright direct assault like it was the Attorney General. It was more subtle. It came in via the top. Let's say a false flag may be certainly worth looking at, being aware of. But it is a case of urgency that is necessary. And while we're in Hosea, just let's have a look at chapter 11. Chapter 11, notice. Verse 5, it says, "And he shall not return to the land of Egypt, but the Assyrian shall be his king, because they refuse to return. And the sword shall abide in his cities, and shall consume his branches and devour them because of their own counsels. And my people are bent to backsliding from me, though they call them to the Most High, none of them will exalt him. How shall I give you up, Ephraim? How shall I deliver you, Israel? How shall I make you as Adamah? And how shall I set you as Zeboim?" Now these are two small villages around Sodom and Gomorrah that went up with Sodom and Gomorrah, or came down with Sodom and Gomorrah. "My heart is turned within me, and my repentings are kindled together." And so there is an urgency that is necessary, an urgency that we all need to make sure that we are holding on to as we look into the future. Now, what I'd like to do is I'd like to just spend a few minutes before I finish talking about what happened the first time around. Because we get tired. Yes, we get tired. Why do we get tired? Well, because it's been 30 years since the death of Mr. Armstrong. I mean, 30 years. Surely, is that not natural? Is that not the way things are? Well, I'd like you to turn to the book of Amos. The book of Amos. Now, Amos was written at different times according to what you read on the internet and what you read in various commentaries. Adam Clark's commentary gives it about 782, 83 BC, something like that. I've got written in my Bible from, I don't know where, 785 BC. Now, I don't know whether that is true. The latest time that I see this is 750 BC, and that's, you get that in Wikipedia. Again, what you find is people, modern assessment, higher textual criticism is constantly trying to push the date back, not back, forwards, because they're trying to show that, oh, it wasn't, there's no God involved. It was just a lucky guess by the book, by the person called Amos. But in fact, every indication is it's dated here. It says, the word of Amos, who was amongst the herdmen of Tekoa. Now, Tekoa is in Judea. It's in south, it's the southern part of, it's south of Israel, anyway. In Tekoa, which he saw concerning Israel. Israel was in the north now. In the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. Now, it wasn't the first Jeroboam, it's the Jeroboam II, the son of Joash, king of Israel, 2 years before the earthquake. Now, if we read Josephus, and we believe what Josephus says, the earthquake occurred when Uzziah went ahead and tried to go into the temple. Now, whether it did or not is a moot point, but Uzziah tried to go into the temple and offer incense on the golden altar before the Holy of Holies, and the high priest and 80 other priests barred his way, and he got really angry with them, and he became leprous. He actually ran out of the temple area. But he did so not only because he was a leprous, according to what Josephus said, is that the entire temple shook, and it talks about the earthquake at the time of Uzziah. Now, 2 years before the earthquake, so again, there were many houses in northern Israel that also shook, that also got damaged in that earthquake as well. And it, if you like, added credence to what Amos had to say. As I say, it could be 750 BC, that'll be about the latest, but the probable date is around about 780 BC. Now, it is all about what is going to happen as far as Israel is concerned, and how Israel is going to go into captivity. How many years is that before they went into captivity? If it's 780 BC or 781, that's 60 years beforehand. So this message came out 60 years before. At the very least, you're looking at 30 years. But I would say that almost certainly 60 is nearer. So 60 years before it actually took place, this warning was given. Now, what happened as far as Mr. Armstrong is concerned? If you look at that kind of time, you're looking back into the 50s and 60s, 1950, 1960 time, aren't you? And that's when he was going full pelt. So there's nothing unusual about the length of time we've had to wait. And the idea that, you know, since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were. No. It's exactly what happened in the case of Amos. The timing is involved, and what Amos did, he started his prophecies here in verse 3. It says, "Where thus says the Eternal, for three transgressions of Damascus." Now that's Syria. That's Syria to the north, northeast of Jerusalem, of Israel. "For this says the Eternal, for three transgressions of Damascus, and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they have threshed Gilead with a threshing instrument of iron." The way they actually behaved themselves was deplorable. They were cruel. It wasn't just being ungodly. They were downright nasty. Downright nasty about it. And this says, verse 6, the Eternal, for three transgressions of Gaza, and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they carried away captives the whole captivity to deliver them up to Edom. In other words, they had a backhanded way and an approach to the captives, the captivity that took place. And it talks about cutting off the inhabitants of Ashdod and Ashkelon. And verse 9, for the Eternal, for three transgressions of Tyre, and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they delivered up the whole captivity to Edom, and remembered not the brotherly covenant. In other words, they were breaking the covenants. And then for three transgressions of Edom, in verse 11, and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, but he did pursue his brother with a sword, and had cast off all pity, and his anger did he tear perpetually, and he kept his wrath. So, again, it's being nasty. It's being humanly nasty. And God says, look, you know better than to behave in this unrighteous way. Ammon as well, in verse 13. Because they've ripped up the women with child in Gilead, and they're making larger borders. Again, it was a nastiness in their methods and everything else that was involved. And believe me, when the Assyrians finally came in, they were nasty. Even more so. This is the Eternal, verse 1 of chapter 2. Three transgressions of Moab, and four, I'll not turn away the punishment thereof, because he burned the bones of the king of Edom into lime. I will send a fire upon Moab. He didn't need to do that. He did it deliberately to humiliate and tear down the king of Edom. And verse 4, this says the Eternal, for three transgressions of Judah, and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof. But notice the difference. Notice the difference. Because they have despised the law of the Eternal, and have not kept his commandments, and their lies caused them to err, like their fathers walked. So they ignored what God, you know, God was dealing with Judah. God was dealing with the house of Judah. And in verse 6, the Eternal said, three transgressions of Israel, and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they sold the righteous for silver, and for poor for a pair of shoes. They pant after the dust of the earth on the head of the poor, and turn aside the way for the meek, and the man and his father will go into the same way to profane my holy name. In other words, they are disobeying God over and over again in ways that, if you like, tear down the poor. They're trying to make the teeth meet on every single deal. And what in fact was happening at that time, there was a certain amount of wealth at that time in Israel. And they had a certain degree of wealth, because they'd actually, in one particular stage, they'd actually taken Damascus. They'd gone against Syria. And although they were at war with Syria continually, the one time they'd actually gone ahead and were on top. And it's interesting as well, what they would do in days gone by is they would put tribute on people. So they had to pay, you know, whoever they conquered, they would have tribute, and the tribute had to be paid back to them. And this they would put up with it for a while, and then they'd go ahead and rebel. So they'd send an army in to impose their rule. And this was going on all the time at that particular juncture. But, you know, what's happening today? What's happening with America? Are they putting tribute on people? You better believe they are, the Western world. The dollar, used as a reserve currency, doesn't have the wealth and the backing behind it. The backing isn't there. And yet we in the Western world, in the Israelite Western world, are living on the backs of the rest of the nations. And we're having to, you know, we're advancing our money supply when there's nothing actually behind it. And we, if you like, extracting tribute from people. And this was happening at this particular time as well. And they also were doing the same thing on an individual basis. They were screwing the poor, you know, screwing every single penny that they could possibly get out of the poor. And the indication is that Amos was chosen very carefully, because he was a gatherer of wild sycamore. He was a herdsman. You know, he was a very poor individual, So he could see exactly what was going on in the northern tribes. And his the poverty that he had, he was a gatherer of wild figs. That's how he eked his income out. And he was a herdsman. And he therefore took this message across to the people at that particular time. But I want you to notice the difference between how he was dealing with all these other nations and how he dealt with Israel and with Judah. Israel and Judah, they were out of line with what God had said. They'd gone away from God. These other nations were never had God, but they were just basically cruel and downright evil. And it's interesting as well, these other nations largely were part of what was known as the Syrian League. Now, going through, listen, I'm running out of time. If you notice in Amos 5, first of all, before we go into the Syrian League, let's have a look at Amos chapter 5. And in verse 27, therefore will I cause you to go into captivity. Now, you just look up the word captivity in the book of Amos. Just go through and just see how Amos forecasts the captivity of the people. But they will be going into captivity beyond Damascus, says the Eternal, so beyond Syria. And they were taken by Tiglath-Pileser was one of them, but Tiglath-Pileser wasn't. It was Sennacherib that was actually took some of them, and then his successor thereafter. But it go on into captivity beyond Damascus, over towards Nineveh, says the Eternal, whose name is the God of hosts. So that is one place that you'll find. But there was a Syrian League that they had, and this is in fact what in fact occurred. If we turn over to 1 Kings 19. There's 1 Kings 19. And he's talking to Elijah, and he comes to the mouth of his cave, and he hears a still small voice, and then he complains in verse 14, and he says, I've been very jealous for the Eternal God of hosts, and I have slain the prophets by the sword, and I only am left, and they seek my life to take it away as well. And he was really down at that particular juncture. And the Eternal said to him, go return on your way to the wilderness to Damascus. And when you come, now Damascus is the capital of Syria. So here is a Syrian nation. When you come, anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. So Hazael was to be anointed. And if you go over to first, and then he also gets Elisha, he says, go ahead and give your cloak to Elisha and appoint Elisha as the one to whom your authority therefore is passed. Now if we go to chapter 20 and in verse 26 it says, and it came to pass at the return of the year that Ben-Hadad numbered the Syrians and went up to Aphek to fight against Israel. And the children of Israel were numbered, and all who were present, and went up against them. And the children of Israel pitched before them like two little flocks of kids. But the Syrians filled the country. And there came a man of God and spoke unto the king of Israel, and said, thus says the Eternal, because the Syrians have said, the Eternal is a God of the hills, but he's not a God of the valleys. I'll deliver all the great multitude into your hand, and you'll know that I am the Eternal. So he's still working with the northern kingdom of Israel at this time. And they pitched one against another 7 days, and it was so that in the seventh day the battle was joined, and the children of Israel slew the Syrians 100,000 footmen in one day. But the rest fled to Aphek, into the city, and there a wall fell upon 20,000 and 7,000 of the men who were left. And Ben-Hadad flew, that was the leader, the king of Syria, and came to the city into an inner chamber. And his servant said to him, behold, now we have heard that the kings of the house of Israel are merciful kings. Let us, I pray you, put sackcloth on our loins and ropes on our heads, and go to the king of Israel, peradventure he'll save your life. So they girded sackcloth on the loins and put ropes on their heads, and came to the king of Israel, and said, your servant Ben-Hadad said, I pray you, let me live. And he said, is he yet alive? He is my brother. Now the men did diligently observe whether anything would come of them, and he did hastily catch it. And they said, Your brother Ben-Hadad, and they said, Go to him, bring him. And Ben-Hadad came forth to him, and he caused him to come up into his chariot. And Ben-Hadad said to him, The cities which my father took from your father I'll restore, and you shall make streets of you in Damascus, and my father made in Samaria. And then said Ahab, I'll send away with you this covenant. And they made a covenant with him and sent him away. Now that covenant was made with Syria. That was, they were continually warring. And this battle of Qaggar in 853 BC, they caused this covenant to exist. And the reason for this covenant, interestingly, we haven't got time to go into it, but Haziel murdered Ben-Hadad, and the reason for this covenant was to actually fight against Salmaneser, the king of Assyria, the king of Assyria, not Syria, Assyria, coming from Nineveh. Now he apparently, in 857, he reached the Mediterranean shores. And in the next year, what he did was he settled many of the Assyrians in that land, and he made settlements. This then goaded everybody, because they could see that he was going to come in and he was going to take them over. So what they did is they made a league with each other. And so all these names, when you look at the book of Amos and all these people that are being mentioned, they were all part of the league. These were members of the league that were being made. And they've actually found a monolith over in what is now Iraq, and it actually has a reference to Ahab as one of these individuals who is part of this league. Now what happened as far as Assyria is concerned, they reckoned that they broke this league. But the trouble is they had to go back next year and break it as well, and the year after, and the year after that, and the year after that. In other words, he's giving all these battles that he won, but in fact he obviously didn't do a very good job. He had a real problem against this league. Now what in fact happened then was that the Second Syrian League took place in about 734. If you turn over to 2 Kings 16. Second Kings 16 and verse 3, it says, He walked the ways of the king of Israel, yes, and he made his son to pass through the fire, talking of the king of Judah now. According to the abominations of the heathen, which the Eternal cast out from before the children of Israel. And he sacrificed and burnt incense in the high places, and on the hills, and under every green tree. Then Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, king of son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to war, and they besieged Ahaz, but couldn't overcome him. So they actually, again, they were in confederacy again. This is the Second Syrian Confederacy. And they were, what were they doing? They were trying to be confederate against who? Against Assyria. Assyria over in the far east was wanting to come in. And remember, what's this? About 100 years later, after the first confederacy, what do we have? Within our time, well, we were now going through the centenary of the First World War, and it's indicative. And they came up in several occasions, and they weren't able to conquer them. But the final occasion that they came up, they did conquer them. Now, what in fact happened here? And it was interesting that Judah sold out. It says, and this time, Rezin, king of Syria, recovered Elath to Syria. And drove the Jews from Elath, and the Syrians came to Elath and dwelt there unto this day. So Ahaz sent messages to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am your servant and your son. Come up and save me out of the hand of the king of Assyria and out of the hand of the king of Israel, which rise up against me. And Ahaz took the silver and gold that was found in the house of the Eternal and in the treasuries of the king's house and sent it for a present to the king of Assyria. So he was actually asking for help from the king of Assyria, and to giving him money to pay his troops to come in and actually sort out this confederacy. So this was what in fact took place. in the first time round. This confederacy existed, and it was what in fact happened. The king of Assyria listened to him, for the king of Assyria went up against Damascus and took it and carried the people away captive to Kir and slew Rezin. So they took care of Syria first, and then later on they went into Israel, because he was confederate with Syria and many of the other areas as well. And they took Tyre, they took the Philistines, they took many of the areas. But it was a confederacy that actually took place. So I thought that would be a little bit of interest. I mean, I haven't really gone into the detail I was hoping to, but let's just finish. Let's turn over to Ezekiel 33. Because this is the problem. This is the problem that we have within the church, and that we've got to make sure that we don't fall into this category. But in Ezekiel 33 and in verse 30, it says, "Also you, son of man, the children of your people still are talking against you by the walls and in the doors of the house, and speak one to another, everyone his brother, saying, come, I pray you, hear what the word of the comes from the Eternal." So they're looking for the word of the Eternal. And the churches are generally, the church, the various groups across the shattered church of God, are looking for the words of the Eternal. But they don't listen to what the Eternal has actually said in the case of the apostle that has been sent at this end time. "And they come to you as the people come, and they sit before you as my people, and they hear your words, but they will not do them. For with their mouth they show much love, but their heart goes after their covetousness." And what in fact happens? Well, we just remind ourselves in Matthew 24, the wording there. But it says, "But if that evil servant shall say in his heart, my Lord delays his coming, and shall begin to smite his fellow servants and drink with the drunken." In other words, it's coming from the heart. Keep in Ezekiel 33, because we're going back there. But it's coming from the heart. The heart is going a certain direction. And this is what's happening here in Ezekiel 33. "And they come as my people come, and they sit there before you as my people. And they hear your words, but they will not do them. For with their mouth they show much love, but their heart goes after their covetousness." In their heart they say, "My Lord delays his coming." And that then influences the way in which they act. They might be able to give we could well give the impression that, oh, we were following what Mr. Armstrong said, we're going down that route, but we're getting weary. We're not actually hanging on to the truth. Because listen to the world tomorrow. What's he dealing with? He's dealing with spiritual conditions, with spiritual mentality, with spiritual outlook on things. And we've got to make sure that our contact with God is maintained. And you know, our lamps are burning and our shoes on our feet, we're ready for off. With their mouth they show much love, but their heart goes after their covetousness. In their heart, he says, "My Lord delays his coming." "And lo, you are unto them as a very lovely song, of one that has a pleasant voice and can play well on an instrument. For they hear your words, but they do not do them. And when this comes to pass, and lo, it will come." So even though it's 30 years down the line, it doesn't make any odds. You know, Amos was giving his prophecies 60 years before it actually took place. And he gave his prophecies which... Again, they were dwelling safely. They had this alliance. I reckon the alliance would therefore save them. They didn't. And the word of Amos came to pass. "And when this comes to pass, and though it will come, then shall they know that a prophet has been among them."